Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Runner's World Podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest advice, news and interviews from across the running world. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. So Ben, what have we got coming up this episode?
This month's podcast is themed around the important topic of eating disorders in athletics. We have the Iron Lady herself, Chrissy Wellington, talking about her own struggles with eating disorders. Marathoner Tom Fairbrother tells us more about his new initiative, Train Brave. Performance and eating disorder dietitian Renee McGregor talks about orthorexia. And RW's very own Jay Maguire opens up about her own experience of anorexia.
Ben, what have we been up to in the past month?
Big highlight would be New York. Not running it, just to clarify immediately.
Yeah.
But we were out there for a yearly Runners World meet where all the international editors go out and we chat about running. It's basically a big nerdy running.
A big geek off in New York.
Yeah, massive. Yeah. And we have a day and a half of industry chat and then a day and a half of shoe brands showing us all their new secret stuff. So that's like the nerds in us really get excited about that.
Is it top secret or can you share any learnings?
It's kind of secret. Some people have gotten brand new things coming out which are... I mean, I had to sign NDAs and I'm not legally, like, I'm not sure if I can...
Fine, leave it there.
We're fine. I'm not even sure if I can mention brands without someone being like, lawyers! but more importantly than all of that was I got to run around Central Park as the build-up for New York Marathon was taking place and I don't think you can ever get better than running when a big race is coming.
Yeah, the excitement.
It was so good. And the weather was really good as well. So like normally November and New York tends to be a bit chilly in that.
Right.
But it was vest weather.
Oh, great.
Right? So I was like, yeah, it was great. Like they were building the finish line, you would run around, all the flags were up. So yeah, that was, I'd say a running highlight was just feeding off that.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it was good.
That sounds great. Slightly less glamorous for me was the Great South Run, which is a very good race, 10 miles in Portsmouth. Again, lovely weather, so it was kind of perfect running conditions. Like often with the Great South Run, it's very windy. So the last 2 miles along the seafront, and they can essentially you can be going well, and then your race is over because you're getting hit by a gale force.
Yep.
But none of that. Yeah, managed to run a PB, which was good. So
come on then. What time?
1:02:13, which is actually
sharp.
Quite a healthy PB for me.
It is.
Better than I thought I'd do.
I'm immediately disappointed that it's not under an hour.
Well, me too. And I had a Morton gel, the kind favoured by Kipchoge and co, and I forgot to use it. So I'm imagining that, you know...
There's your 2 minutes and 13 seconds.
Exactly. I'm going for sub hour with the Morton. So
for sure.
Next year I'll be back with my Morton to try and go sub one.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So our first guest is a four-time world Ironman champion, a world record holder and the global lead for health and well-being at Parkrun. Yet she says her biggest battles have been with disordered eating. Chrissy Wellington, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Thank you for having me. Great to have the opportunity to speak.
Well, as I alluded to in the intro, you're best known for your extraordinary achievements in Ironman triathlon. But underneath, I know you had a history of eating disorders. When did that begin?
It really began aged about 16. I became aware that a close friend was bulimic and she confided in me. And far from being revulsed, I was actually intrigued by it. And I think at that stage, I was being bombarded, as many teenagers are, with images. At that time in magazines, now more in social media, you know, images of the perfect female figure. And I think I internalized those messages and wanted to try and achieve it, and had up until then a fantastic relationship with food, didn't really think about food, pretty much ate what I wanted, was an active child, and really didn't have any problems with body weight. But I think it was this desire for control and this fear of being out of control and this fear of not conforming to a stereotypical image that drove me towards those behaviors. And it was really a combination of restricting my intake and also making myself sick. So it was around the age of, I'd say, 16, 17, continued into my first year at university, really.
And so your relationship with food was kind of established before you began training. So, and what you thought image and those associations with being thin, did that stem from your youth rather than training and triathlon and those sorts of things?
Absolutely. I came to triathlon and sport relatively late, and the disordered eating practices preceded that. As a child and a teenager, I did sport socially, so it wasn't something that I ever wanted to pursue to a higher level. And food was something I always enjoyed. I'd always been a good eater. My parents, you know, exposed me to a range of different foods. So I really didn't have a problem. And I wouldn't say blame, but attribute the problems to the images that I was exposed to through teenage magazines and that. And being quite a controlling person, someone that's, I'm also quite a perfectionist.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I saw in that something to aspire to. And you become increasingly aware of your attractiveness to the opposite sex. And I think I thought that, thin was beautiful, thin was what was expected, thin was, boys, men wanted to see, and to achieve that I needed to control my food intake. But really I managed, I think, to address some of these problems in the first year at university when I was exposed again to a range of different foods and kind of just let go a little bit actually. And the same friend that was bulimic in my teenage years actually sent me an article as to the impact, highlighting the impacts of bulimia, because she was aware that I was adopting some of these behaviours. And that shocked me. Yeah. The growth of hair on your arms or all over your body, the rotting of teeth, all of those things that we increasingly know are associated with bulimia and disordered eating. And I think that shocked me. I also had a boyfriend at that time, so I was a lot more comfortable in my body. My academic work was going very well. So I think I was just really happy and lost a little bit of what I call, the control. And then I went traveling around the world for 2 years and again just ate and drank. And I gained quite a lot of weight for me.
Yeah.
While I was traveling. And then when I was in Asia, I decided I was going to become a vegetarian and I wanted to get a handle again on what I was eating after a kind of unhealthy year or so, And it was again in Asia that I just started to control a little bit what I ate, reduce the portions, and cut out some of what I called, the bad foods. And then I came back to the UK and I was doing my MA in Manchester, and that was when I was really gripped again by disordered eating, and this time anorexia rather than bulimia. And I this obsession with calories and calorie counting just took control. And now I have a real issue with the emphasis on calories and calorie counting. I think it, you know, just a throwback to the days where I think that that really was something that kind of compounded my problem. So I restricted my food intake and I also started running. And that's really where I had my kind of first foray into running. I started taking it a lot more seriously. I lost a lot of weight. My parents were very, very worried. My brother especially gave me quite a lot of tough love, which I'm incredibly grateful for. And it was as I think two things enabled me to kind of progress along the path of recovery. I wouldn't say you're ever fully recovered, but definitely, you know, progress along that path. Firstly was the realization of how much my behaviors were impacting others, especially my family. And to hurt them is something that I'd never want to do. So that was really concerning for me. And secondly, I started to realize that food was fuel and make that association between food and performance. So instead of it being the enemy and something that had to be controlled, well, I guess I controlled it in a different way. And I channeled my eating towards something that was a lot more healthy. So I was eating a lot more. I was eating a lot more to fuel my performance. I became a lot more informed about sports and nutrition. And I think those two things really, really helped me address some of those problems. And then latterly, I found triathlon and became a professional triathlete. And since then, I've had a much more positive relationship with food,
yeah.
Although it's just not always easy.
I mean, one of the words you've used there a bit is control, and I guess we know there's some worrying statistics around athletes and runners being more susceptible to eating disorders. Do you think that at its heart is about trying to control things?
I think there are several factors. I would hazard a guess that the common denominator is that we are quite controlling. We like routine, we like structure, we like to plan, we like to be organized, because without those traits you wouldn't be a successful athlete. So I think a lot relates to control. I think there are athletes in certain sports that are more susceptible, sports that have a weight related our weight related,
like so running, whether, or cycling, or something.
Running, cycling, some extent triathlon, rowing, yeah. Where there are weight categories, I think that's the word I was trying to find, like weight categories, you know, that kind, yeah, of thing, where there's the aesthetic element, so your dance, you know, ballet, things like, yeah, that as well are going to, I think athletes are going to be more susceptible.
You mentioned, Chrissy, that when you discovered triathlon and your relationship with food changed because you realised the kind of the benefits to a certain extent of healthy eating. But do you think that perhaps in some ways you replaced control over eating with kind of control over training? Was it just putting the emphasis of obsession somewhere else?
Absolutely. It was a struggle, especially when I retired.
Yeah.
From professional sport and was no longer training, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I had to look at my diet because I don't like the kind of calorie in, calorie out equation, but I wasn't doing as much exercise. I just, yeah, you know, didn't need to eat as much as I,
yeah,
as I was. And that was difficult. It was difficult, and I saw my body changing.
Mm.
And it needed to change. You know, as an athlete, I was very, my body was very functional.
Yeah.
It enabled me to serve a purpose, but was I holistically healthy? Probably not.
Mm.
And I think on retirement, I realized I needed to get my body holistically healthy.
Yeah.
And I think as retired athletes, as athletes, we need to be honest about the, you know, the toll that sometimes our sport does take on our body, mm-hmm, and the difficult choices that, yeah. that are made and the implications that that has for female and male hormonal health, bone health, holistic health. But yes, sorry, just going back to your question, I did replace that control over food with, you know, training.
Yeah.
And I had to be very cognizant of that when I retired, and that's why I unfortunately don't think I've ever fully recovered, but I do have strategies to be able to manage the thoughts and the compulsions.
Yeah.
So just at the most basic level, previously I had, you know, if there was a piece of cake, I just wouldn't eat it.
Yeah.
Just would not eat it. Now I'd eat it. I might still feel guilty, but I'll still eat it.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I wouldn't say I'm ever free of those thoughts, free of those compulsions, but I can manage them and I can control them.
I'll tell you, to some extent. The guilt's still there for me with a piece of cake, and I have nothing to do with being a professional.
But I think also, just as a parent now, very, very mindful of the fact you're a role model for us to our daughter, and I would, you know, children are very, very perceptive, and I would never want her to adopt, you know, the behaviours that I have, and to, you know, for me to be a negative influence on her. But also, neither do I want to be dishonest. I want to share with her when the time is right some of the challenges that I've experienced, in the hope that it, you know, it would mean that she doesn't go down that path. But I think as a parent, it's really, really important to take that look at yourself and make sure that your behaviours are healthy.
What do you think are some of the misconceptions currently around food and its impact on performance? Because, I mean, we often hear stuff like, is lighter faster?
Yeah, that's a really common misconception, especially in running. And increasingly in triathlon, which is unfortunate, because triathlon is one sport rather than three separate sports. So you need to be strong and robust and powerful across all three disciplines.
Yeah.
And so, especially for triathlon, light is definitely not necessarily faster, because I know for myself, if I lost too much weight, my swim would suffer.
Yeah.
My bike power would go down. So yes, I might be able to run faster, but if I'm getting to the run, you know, 30 minutes back because my swim and bike have been appalling, well, that's not going to help me in a race. So it's that delicate, you know, delicate balance. And if, you know, that you only have to look at triathlon start line to see that every athlete is different. But you know, also the case you know, with female marathoners, body types are so different. And we've had some, you know, there are some very successful athletes, they're not necessarily stereotypically stick thin, but the fact that they're strong and robust means that they can, you know, sustain a high level of performance, maybe a lot longer than someone that is thinner and potentially a little bit more fragile. And again, looking at the longer term, what are the implications of such a physique for bone health, for hormonal health, for reproductive health, all of those things. So definitely we need to look critically at the claim that, you know, light is fast. I guess one other issue that I'm particularly concerned about is the association between exercise and food. So, for example, you know, the message that you've eaten a donut, this means an hour of swimming, or you've done an hour of swimming, you've earned that cake. You know, and it's just, it's not a, you know, a reward-based kind of equation. It shouldn't be about that. I guess I have this concern that exercise is equated only with calorie burning.
Yeah.
You know, people do exercise, they want to burn a certain amount of calories. And I don't think that's a sustainable motivator.
No.
I think we need to be inspired, you know, by a whole range of different things that encourage us to exercise, with maybe changing our body type being one, if that is something that you want to do or has been recommended by a healthcare professional. But I don't think that should be the sole and principal motivator.
Yeah.
No, definitely. I think the way that people possibly get into the idea of exercise is needs to change. I think that there's that step counting to burn certain, you know, like hitting that is a great way of doing it, but then it equates to sort of burning a certain amount. And it's a, whereas no one says like, oh, you should learn to run and go running because you might feel very happy afterwards. Like that would be a really, that would be nice.
Yeah,
like,
you know,
So
I guess one of the biggest things that's happened to recreational exercise in the 21st century would be parkrun. And I know obviously you're involved with parkrun as well. Do you feel like in some ways that has changed the image of what it means to exercise and be a runner? Because at parkrun, everyone's welcome.
I think more broadly it's changed the conception of what being active is. And we're so incredibly proud of the fact that the finish times at parkrun are getting slower, because it's indicative to us that we're engaging those that probably have the most to gain from what parkrun offers. But you know, being active to us is running, jogging, walking, volunteering, come along and spectate, go and throw, you know, stones in a pond or feed the duck. Just be outside with your friends.
Yeah.
Move your body in whatever way you want to in the open air. And there's incredible value in that. And I think parkrun is helping to highlight that.
Mm.
And also success as an achievement as a very, very individual thing. So for some people, success is a 15-minute 10K, and for others, it's a 5K, and for others, it's a 50-minute or more 5K, and we celebrate both of those achievements as, you know, equally impressive. We also celebrate volunteering and reward volunteering. So I really like that. It's always a leveller. It doesn't matter what your position or what you're placing or what your time. Everyone is doing 5K.
Yeah.
And everyone's achievement in that is celebrated. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoy working for parkrun. And I think, you know, our work has only just started in terms of really trying to engage some of the less active members of society who, like I said, have probably most to gain from this kind of community social intervention that we offer.
So what about now, Chrissy? How's your running? Let's talk about running. How is it?
I'm trying to be the best I can in the context of my life now, to be honest. So it was quite challenging after I retired just to kind of reduce the volume and disassociate myself with the identity of simply being a triathlete and move away from the kind of structure and routine. And initially I found it quite difficult to set new goals for physical activity, because I just felt that people were going to be looking at me and judging me and saying, oh, she's not the athlete she used to be. And I think there's been enough water under the bridge, especially after we had our daughter, that I feel ready to set new goals, but also to see success as something different than simply a time or a pace or a position. So I might not be aspiring anymore to be world champion or to break world records or to win races, but I can still achieve and I can still be successful in my own right. Yeah. So last year I did the London Marathon. It was my 40th birthday treat to myself. Yeah. And I was really proud to go 2:49 and for my husband and daughter to be watching that. And then, having said I'd never do an ultra marathon, I did an ultra marathon and was surprised actually by how much I enjoyed it. So I really, really enjoyed my first couple of ultras.
Yeah.
And I've got Valencia Marathon coming up in
December.
less than three weeks.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then I have bitten the bullet and entered Comrades.
Oh, wow.
There we go.
Yeah. So that's a big goal for next year, and I'm sure there'll be smaller stepping stones. But for me, running is something that's more, I guess, easier. It's easier to do in terms of fitting it around my life. And whereas previously sport was the main focus, now it can't be. It's an important part of my life, but all of my decisions can't be based on my desire to achieve a certain time at Valencia or then at Comrade. So I have to see my performance in that kind of context. But yeah, no, excited about Valencia. And
Rick, have you done Valencia?
Having a bit of time off over Christmas.
Someone's done Valencia.
I know there's a few people training for it at the minute. Yeah. But it's meant to be great. It's meant to be quick
really...
and almost guaranteed good marathon weather. So, yeah.
Now you've jinxed me.
No, yeah, with the wettest, worst Valencia.
Rain in a few hills or something. Yeah.
Well, Christy, thank you very, very much for coming on the Runner's World podcast. We really, really appreciate you coming on and talking about eating disorders and athletics, because we think it's a subject that needs to be talked about more, and it sounds like there are people who are making the right moves in this area. But thanks again for coming on.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
We discussed this a little bit off mic, but one of the reasons I think that eating disorders are prevalent in running is because of beliefs such as lighter equals faster. And let's be frank, in some cases that can be true, but it doesn't tell the full story, of course, and it can be dangerous if it's misinterpreted. It's much better, I think, for runners to think about being strong, lean and healthy. I remember two marathons I did, both London actually. One I finished in like 3:14 or something, didn't lift weights at all, and was probably 3 or 4 kilograms lighter than the next year when I had done like a weightlifting routine and actually we're around 3:02. So it was a big improvement being heavier. But I just, the weight that I put on was useful muscle weight.
I remember years ago, quite a few years ago, I was having a chat with Ron Hill, name drop. And Ron, we were talking about marathons and I said, it's not really for me, I'm a bit too big. Because I believed, and he was like, nonsense. He said, and he was talking about, and I forget the name of the runner, but he's a guy that he ran with in his prime who was as big as me.
Right.
So like 6'2 and like 80 kilos. So he's like, not traditional size, sort of like, I'm a bit more than 80. I've just been generous to myself. But he was saying, that was quite interesting to hear from, like, I think that perhaps the modern image is distorted what I consider to be the right size and shape.
Yeah.
Whereas you talk to someone like, the experience that is Ron Hill, and he'll be like, that's nonsense. Yeah. Anyone who can be a size and can run a good marathon.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty... Yeah, from someone as renowned as Ron Hill, that's pretty telling,
encourages,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty telling, yeah. As well as running, Ben, you're a keen cyclist. Because it's easy to think of this stuff as just a problem afflicting running, but it's not, is it? I mean, this kind of obsession with lightness... Is
no, if you talk in comparison to cycling, running's pretty healthy in terms of image.
Yeah.
This was actually brought to my attention on Twitter the other day. I'd never really considered it. Someone that I follow called Grace, she tweeted about the image of male men in cycling and particularly like brands and adverts and the general thing. And actually, it's not a relatable, unless you are a master of the mountains. Like that's the main image. It's like a
kind of Chris Froome.
Yeah, it's your lean climber. Like that's a lot of mostly major brands, imagery within features.
Yeah,
all of it is that. And so I think running comparatively to cycling, like the what's put out there in terms of the shape and size of runners, is way better off.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, that's good to hear. That's
Cycling, I read a lot of it. And I've never really thought about it, but on reflection, there's one body shape pretty much.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to know what listeners think about that. Do you think that running's getting the right messages out there when it comes to exercise and weight loss? Let us know. podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
This is the Runner's World Podcast.
We're joined now by 2:59. No, I'm joking. We're joined now by 2:34 marathon runner and co-founder of Train Brave, a campaign to raise awareness about eating disorders in athletics. Tom, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Can you begin by telling us a little bit about your background and your experience of eating disorders?
Yeah, so I guess my story is a bit unusual for most people. So I, obviously, eating disorders are more common amongst women than men, particularly younger women. Whereas I was kind of in my mid-20s, I just kind of started taking running a bit more seriously. So I headed out to, you know, to Kenya to train, having kind of enjoyed kind of a sort of astronomic rise from kind of a Sunday morning footballer to a marathon runner.
Yeah,
very competitive, you know, kind of riding this wave of, you know, performance after performance and PBs, and headed out there to train just as part of my gap year before starting uni. So kind of amongst, like, you know, it was a very high performance environment, kind of lots of elite athletes and kind of Olympians and that kind of thing.
God. 0 to 100, like, really quickly.
I'm that kind of person, sort of. I'm kind of like an all or nothing personality. But it was more that just the opportunity arose that, you know, I had this period of time and I'd managed to save some money. So it just was too good opportunity to turn down, really. But it was... The whole experience was pretty much a disaster. You know, I headed out on my, there on my own, so kind of very, very kind of isolated. And I'd just done my first marathon a couple of months beforehand, so still was kind of not really running, had a few niggles and that kind of thing. So I broke down within probably the first 2 or 3 days, my just with a calf problem. So there I am kind of in this elite Kenyan altitude training running camp.
Unable to run.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, runners when they're injured are terrible.
They're
the worst at the best of times. But when you're in a this remote location where you're only there to run, you know, it was really, really tough. So I think that's probably one of the contributing factors, because I was obviously very low, quite vulnerable, kind of missing home comforts and friends. And I just got chatting to a guy. He was an Australian guy. I think he was like a masters athlete and a coach. We just got chatting about, he asked me kind of what I weighed. So we just got chatting about it. And he said, well, you know, if you want to improve your marathon time, you could do with losing, you know, X amount. You know, it was kind of a throwaway remark. I don't think he meant anything kind of...
Yeah, no, just said in the context of just like...
Yeah, it's just one of those...
Performance-based weight losses equates to...
Was like, oh, you weigh this, if you weighed that, you'd be even faster, which was the sort of comment I'd probably just, you know...
Well, it gets said quite a lot.
Yeah, and, you know, for most people, you know, you are able just to brush it off. And, but I think because I was there and wasn't able to train and was obviously probably in quite a vulnerable state, it kind of just festered away. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks, you know, I thought, well, if I can't train, at least I can, you know, cut down on what I'm eating, or maybe, you know, just maybe won't have lunch today. Or and it just started these really unhealthy sort of habits and behaviours, which, you know, spiralled really, really quickly. I came back from Kenya probably a month later, because I just was, you know, I was unable to train. I tried to start running again a couple of times and just thought, I need to go home. But I was, by that point, I was just obsessed with my weight.
Right.
You know, I'd weigh myself several times a day.
Wow.
I was cutting more and more my intake down.
Yeah.
And that just spiraled and spiraled, rather than kind of, I'll come home, you know, with my friends and family and a few more home comforts. If anything, it probably got worse, because I came back feeling like I was a bit of a fraud, because I'd made this big thing about the fact that I was going out to Kenya, you know, just a guy from Suffolk who, you know, it was not something that people really did. So to have come back so quickly, kind of not able to run, it was quite, I felt a bit humiliated by the whole experience.
Did when you came back, I mean, if you've not been running, but you've obviously spent 3 weeks restricting your diet dramatically, were you lighter when you came? Did people notice?
I was cross training while I was out there. So obviously it's very kind of high altitude. So training wise, I did do quite a lot of training, aerobic training. You know, I was aqua jogging or on the cross trainer a couple of times a day. So my fitness had improved whilst I was away, but that coupled with just the fact that I was massively kind of depriving myself of any, you know, towards the end I was just eating nothing at all. My weight had dropped quite a lot within those 4 weeks I was out there, and that just became, you know, the buzz I would have got from running PBs or races, whatever, I was getting that buzz from, you know, weighing myself each morning and seeing that I'd lost some weight, which looking back now is a terrible thing. But once you're amongst it, and it was just all I really had to focus on.
I think that, I mean, I don't know, but this is speculation, but I would assume that a lot of people fall into that. That's how it becomes the obsessive, like the goal
exactly.
hitting.
Is like, I think certain personalities, especially, if you can be quite, people who are quite competitive and sort of perfectionists, that kind of drive to kind of get that buzz from achieving something, which I would normally have got from, you know, healthier pursuits. But actually, it was just, by this point, I was back running, you know, quite big mileage, but it still kind of continued and just got really, 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 really unsustainable. And looking back, really dangerous.
How bad did it get to? At your worst, I mean, what were you doing and how were you feeling?
I guess my daily routine, I guess, is probably one way. I would get up, run for probably, a minimum probably of an hour, come back, maybe have a shake, but maybe not. Often I'd have the shake, feel bad that I'd have the shake, and throw the shake back up. Go to work, eat nothing all day, come home, sort of pretend to have a really, really healthy dinner because I was living at home with my family.
Right.
Then probably sneak upstairs and throw that up. And then often after I'd done that, go back out for another run, then come home, go to bed. And it sounds horrendous, but that was generally my routine for... You know, so everything was affected by it because socially I just didn't really see my friends because I just was, I guess I tried to avoid any situation that would have broken that routine. So going out for dinner or going out for drinks or whatever. So that aspect was there. My sleep was really affected because obviously you get really, really bad stomach kind of hunger pains. You know, in the middle of the night you wake up and your stomach's just... you're just in agony, you don't sleep very well, and then you wake up, you've not really slept, and you're really irritable. And then you're just, you know, it's really, really hard to focus at work because you're just, you know, almost nodding off at your desk because you're just, you know, you're absolutely starving, you're exhausted.
Wow.
But you're just caught in this cycle of...
And this was all secret.
And I think that's what... it was. Looking back, it was really easy to hide it, which I think is a real... problem, and it's quite scary because none of my friends or family are runners. I think clearly my weight was plummeting really quickly. You know, I'd lost a lot of weight. My appearance had changed quite drastically. But because I was running quite high mileage, you know, people were just like, oh, you know, you're really dedicated to training.
Yeah, you can justify it, can't you? Like, oh, obviously I'm losing weight because I'm doing all this running.
Yeah, so it was kind of like, I'm in this cycle, I've got to run. Because if I suddenly stopped running and kept losing weight, people would start to ask questions. So I felt like I had to run to justify the weight loss. But obviously running was the last thing I should have been doing at that time because I was so kind of unwell. The fact I could hide it was just...
Just with the... I guess you went over to Kenya and you had this kind of performance mindset, and then it was about losing weight to be initially with the promise of being a faster runner. What was the reality when you lost all that weight? Did it actually improve your running, or did it have the opposite effect?
No, because I was already at a healthy weight. Yeah, you know, I wasn't like I was carrying a little bit of timber or whatever. You know, was, you know, I'd been running and played sport my whole life, and you know, I was, you know, looking back at photos of me, you wouldn't have said I was someone who would obviously benefit from losing weight. I was, you know, very quickly what happened, I just got injury after injury because, you know, I wasn't recovering after runs with the right nutrition. I was overtraining, you know, I would not take a rest day. You know, to me, getting up and going for a run meant I was in minus calories for the day, you know. And if I then didn't run, that would have been a real issue. So I would constantly get niggles from overtraining. And I was, obviously I'd lost so much muscle mass. I was just really, really weak, you know. So my performance is it just dropped off simply because the quality of my training was so poor because it was just all junk.
Yeah.
And I'd get to, you know, evening races and I'd not had anything to eat all day, you know, and you're just ready for bed and you're trying to then run a 10K or something. And
wow. Yeah.
So it's this kind of assumption that, you know, okay, I weigh this much and I can run this fast.
Yeah.
If I lose this, I'll run that time. It's just, clearly there's a point where if someone is, you know, obese or, you know, severely overweight, clearly that someone like that would
benefit
from losing weight. Yeah. But then there definitely becomes like a point where it then you cross this threshold where it then becomes detrimental.
Mm.
And I think there with the awareness of the fact that it's not just this linear relationship of, you know, constant weight loss doesn't equal constantly getting faster. Because there is a point for everyone where suddenly you're underweight, you know, underfueled, and it is detrimental. And I think...
Yeah, definitely.
Crossing that line, I think it's really easy to cross that line.
Mm.
And I think it's really important that people are aware that there is a point where, you know, it is not just going to keep...
Well, how did you find that succeeding line? What was the point for you when you just... I mean, was it performance-based or was it family stepping in? How did you sort of recover from this sort of spiral?
I think looking back, I probably knew all along that my behaviour was... I don't think there was any point where I thought this is me,
this is great.
Or this is normal. Yeah. I think all along I was probably aware that this wasn't a great idea. Mm. But it becomes, you know, pretty quickly you're not really in control of it at all.
Mm.
You know, it's like all consuming. Yeah. I don't think at any point, you know, it wasn't a case of, I know this is unhealthy and I'll just stop it when I can. It's like once an eating disorder's kind of got hold of you, it's pretty much all consuming and you can't, you know, you're not, it's 24/7. It's not just at meal times and stuff. So,
yeah, for sure.
So probably the point for me was when I went to the dentist. So I'd had a lot of toothache. This was kind of almost coming up to 2 years since I'd been to Kenya at this point.
Yeah.
And I just went to the dentist with lots of pain in my front teeth.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, just did the appointment. He was like, you know, you're going to need this done and that done. Mm. And, you know, he said, oh, you know, go and book the appointment and whatever, just as your standard appointment. But then as I was leaving, he said, oh, can I?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Just have a quick word with you. So then the dental nurse went out and it was just me and the dentist. And he was like, look, is there anything you want to tell me?
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, what does he mean? He was like, look, you're mid-20s, but you've lost 75% of your front teeth. You know, and I wasn't even aware of this, I think, because it happened. So you don't suddenly lose that much tooth. He was like, you know, there's two causes to this. It's either kind of acid reflux, you know, like heartburn essentially, which is generally in elderly people.
Yeah.
He said, or it's, you know, from excess vomiting, you know, and the acid in your stomach. And he's like, you're 25 years old. He said, I'm almost certain it's not reflux. He said, I'm looking at you, you told me you run a lot, you know, you're very slim.
Mm.
he was like, "Oh, are you making yourself sick?" And it was like the first time anyone had ever
actively confronted you about it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'd had kind of comments, you know, throwaway comments in the pub from people about my weight and, you know, like looking like I was ill and that kind of stuff. But no one had directly said, you know, "Are you making yourself sick?" And it was kind of, it was so, he presented it so objectively.
Right.
It couldn't really, there was no way you could argue or deny
it. And the facts are completely, like, he's a dentist.
He's a dentist. You've lost this much tooth. Yeah, yeah. There's two causes. Yeah. It can only be this one. And it was quite a massive load off my shoulders, really. I mean, I think I'd wanted to tell someone for a while, but was just scared, you know, and my self-worth was kind of, you know, rock bottom, that I would never, ever probably have approached someone, because I would have assumed the state I was in that they would have just laughed at me or disowned me or whatever, which obviously is not true. But
at the time,
it's almost like,
but you're not sleeping. I mean, as you said, like, you're not sleeping, you're irrational. You're like, everything, your body's not functioning in a sort of...
So you almost use that as a way to stay, to keep up the behaviour by saying, oh, well, you can't stop because people will laugh at you.
Mm. Well, I think that's a good time for us to talk about Train Brave, because I know one of the kind of key things of Train Brave is you want to make it easier for people to talk about eating disorders and athletics and also to sort of train coaches around being able to have those difficult conversations with athletes.
Yeah.
Could you just tell us a little bit about the Train Brave mission and why you wanted to set it up?
Yeah, I guess I've felt for a while there's been, you know, a few athletes over the past sort of 2 or 3 years who have come out and spoken about their issues with food or their, you know, overtraining or, you know, energy deficiency. But it's always been kind of individual athletes coming out of their own backs to write blogs. And there's always this huge outpouring. And then it kind of dies down until the next person does it.
Yeah.
And it feels like the onus is already always on individual athletes to do that, which it feels like that's a big thing for people to do.
Yeah.
It's a huge step for people to come out so publicly and kind of vocally. So the idea was to try and kind of join everyone up a little bit, so that it's not just individual people coming out and it not feeling like a huge deal to do that.
Yeah.
So trying to kind of join everyone together to show more people that, you know, there's no shame in this. You know, you're not the only person.
Yeah.
So hopefully try and encourage more people to, you know, not necessarily speak out, because not everyone would want ever want to do that, and we wouldn't pressure it, but to actually, more for people who are currently suffering, to do something about it.
Yeah.
And not feel like they're going to get laughed at or ridiculed or...
Yeah.
So but just a support network, essentially.
Yeah, so that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect, I guess, is if we're then going to encourage more people to speak out and seek out, there needs to be... there needs to be support for people.
Yeah.
So whether that's, you know, coaches feeling more comfortable, you know, speaking to athletes if they see something which they've got concerns about, or better links between coaches and clubs and, you know, professional support, or clubs creating an environment whereby, you know, the emphasis isn't all on, you know, appearance or... you know, the way you look or weight or times and that kind of thing, just so it's, because clearly, you know, the majority of clubs and coaches are really supportive, but there are obviously some instances where you hear of athletes saying they were pressured to lose weight, or, you know, maybe not directly, but, you know, just comments regarding their appearance or their size, and just trying to just make people aware that, you know, the majority of runners are already at a very healthy weight compared to the rest of the population.
For sure.
So, you know, losing weight should not be the first. You know, if you want to get faster, that should be almost like a last resort.
Yeah.
And if so, done professionally and, you know, sustainably and over time.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the campaign, really. We just want everyone to be more aware, and hopefully people feel more comfortable, you know, having the difficult conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you get a sense that this is more commonplace than even you realised?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make throwaway remarks, but I would say this is massively prevalent. Just, I would say even, you know, I wrote a blog a couple of years ago, which, for The Guardian, which is kind of how I shared my story publicly. And, you know, I reckon I've had at least 100 people say they are currently suffering or have suffered from grassroots, you know, someone who's just done their first half marathon or 10K, up to like Olympic medalists have said, you know, throughout my career, this happened. I felt pressurized by the governing bodies or coaches to look or, you know, weigh a certain amount, which, and it's not just running either. I feel like across all sports, cycling especially.
For sure.
I feel like that's just this huge issue kind of under the surface, which is weighting. And actually running is probably ahead of certain other sports in terms of the support it offers. So I feel like there's still this, especially at kind of an elite level, this culture of, you know, everyone knows it goes on, but it's just
part and parcel.
No one wants to be the one to rock the boat, especially where you've got people's funding in, you know, their livelihoods on the line.
For sure.
No one wants to jeopardize that. So, I feel like it's kind of waiting to all come to the surface, really.
Yeah, definitely. Can you tell us a bit about the event that's happening in December?
Yeah, so the event is on Sunday the 9th of December in London. So we're going to have a few talks from three or four people who have suffered with either relative energy deficiency or eating disorders at different levels about their own experiences. But also we'll have talks from Renee McGregor from a nutritional and psychological point of view. And then Nikki Kia will also be talking about some of the physiological consequences and the hormonal issues. And so hopefully we're trying to cover off all aspects where, you know, you're getting the personal stories, some of the causes, you know, some tips people can take away, just so that the event is kind of, we don't want it to feel like it's just, you know, a workshop for coaches or, you know, just a talk from a runner. It's, we're trying to cover off all angles, really. So anyone can come along, just learn more, whether they feel like their own relationship with food is not particularly healthy, or whether it's a coach who wants to broaden their understanding, or clubs want to better support their coaches, the majority of whom are obviously volunteers with other jobs and things. So the idea was just to kind of get everyone in a room, and then hopefully the takeaway from it is that we'll, because we don't just want it to be kind of a one-off event, we kind of want to almost be pushing and lobbying for more resources to be created. Whether, we don't know what those are yet, whether that's kind of handbooks for runners or courses for coaches to go on, or, you know, whatever that is. So that a bigger takeaway from the event will be things that we can go away and action and try and encourage, whether that's governing bodies or clubs or whatever, to
It sounds great.
It sounds like such an important sort of educational, like, thing that I think, as you say, the scratching the surface of what could possibly be quite a large issue. It's kind of nice. I think it's key that people have an opportunity to be informed slightly more about it. I mean, even just working on this, like, coming before talking to you guys and hearing some talking about it with other people and sort of not really understanding the volume of, like, how things, and then talking to Renee about orthorexia and how that's sort of like the rise of that and those sorts
of... It just feels like there's more and more pressure on people in general, but obviously athletes as well, you know, to look a certain way or to, you know, be a certain body shape. And it feels like there's more and more pressure. And so maybe with that, awareness of these issues is rising, but it still feels like that, you know, are coaches seeing some things and they just, are they just scared to say anything because they just think, I don't want to make this worse? It's just so easy to think, I don't know what to say, so I'll just say nothing. And that can, if anything, be more dangerous than saying kind of the wrong thing.
Tom, go on, sorry.
I was going to say thanks very much.
Well, please do.
I was going to say thank you very much, Tom, for joining us. That was really, really interesting and, very enlightening.
Yeah, I'm going to come along to the event on Sunday the 9th. Really looking forward to it. And, thanks again for being on the podcast.
And if anyone wants to find out anything about Train Brave, where should they go?
Yeah, so we're on Twitter and Instagram, but probably the best place is just trainbrave.org.
Great. Thanks again, Tom.
That's okay. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
We've been joined by Jane, the Deputy
digital editor from Runner's World, who has her own experience of eating disorders and running. So thanks for joining us, Jane.
No problem.
And talking about this, because I guess it's not really an easy subject.
No, I think it takes a while, and I think that's one thing. Like, it took me years to be cool with talking about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of not a pressure, but, you know, some people can't talk about it, and that's cool too. But I think the more people talk about it, the less it becomes not like a big deal, or, you know,
less of a stigma.
Yeah, less of a kind of, oh my gosh, you've had that, and it becomes who you are in a way.
So can you tell us then what your experience was with it, eating disorder?
So I would probably have been about 16, 17, and it's kind of very classic. I think every teenager going through that time struggles with their body image a bit, and I just went too far, and it got very unhealthy very quickly. Mm. And luckily, I was still under the NHS as a child, so my parents were able to. I think if you go into the eating disorder kind of system of an adult, you're treated in a very they haven't had experience as an adult, but because I was a child, I knew that once I got very unwell, I wanted to educate myself, because I think when you get to a certain point, the kind of treatment is we need to get weight on quickly, because you're very, you know, your body can't survive as it is.
Yeah.
But my parents were able to kind of, you know, I had a brilliant dietitian, I was very lucky. I went to a great place in Dagenham, and they let me kind of educate my body how to eat again.
Okay.
Because I knew for me that drinking a really, you know, drinking 700 calories in a drink was one, terrifying, and two, it didn't really teach me about food and about how eating well was.
Yeah.
I was very underweight, and it was a real, it was kind of, everyone thinks it's kind of, you know, you get an eating disorder because you're obsessed about food, but it's not. It's kind of not just about that. It's about everything.
Mm.
And it's about kind of control, but also kind of, I don't know. I think, people think, oh, you're just obsessed with restricting food. But it's kind of actually food is your entire life. And it's kind of, you quickly learn these tricky kind of habits. And I wouldn't ever talk about them because I don't want to trigger anything for anyone else.
Yeah.
But, you know, you learn these little tricks and these little things, and it just becomes, like Tom said, it becomes your... You have this real structure to your life, and anything that changes that structure is terrifying.
So this is your way to keep it secret, and is that what you were trying to do?
I kept it secret, but obviously I was kind of quite young, and I was living at home, and my mum, both my parents realised very early on what was going on.
Yeah,
and I went to my GP, and I think this is a real problem. Again, this isn't about running, but it's a real problem in. And it's been brought up in Parliament recently, I think, that when you go to your GPs are wonderful, but they're not trained in eating disorders. So you go to a GP and they'll weigh you and they'll look at your BMI and they'll say, nah, you're okay, you're in the right kind of
zone.
And in a way, that was fuel to my fire. Someone saying, oh, no, you're not thin enough to be anorexic.
Yeah.
That I was then like, great, okay, like, that's it, I'll prove you wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was probably the way, you know, that GP wouldn't have, it was just the language used was completely, completely wrong. And I think you don't have to be dramatically underweight to have an anorexic mindset.
No.
You don't. If you have an unhealthy relationship with food, the number on the scales doesn't matter. It's what's going on in your head.
It's the same with alcohol, right? I don't think alcohol is defined by volume of drinks a week. It's reasons for drinking, ability not to drink.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's that, isn't it? It's the effect it has over you and your lack of power to do anything about it.
Yeah. But because of that, it was probably about a year later that I actually, you know, got the help I needed. And by that point, I'd lost a lot of weight in a year. Like, that's a long time to be living with this. And I dropped out of school. I wasn't well enough to go to school. I wasn't well enough to do my A-levels. So it was kind of, that had got really bad in that time. And it wasn't that GP's fault, but it was, if I'd got the help I needed a year before. And I do think you have, for me, everyone has a different experience, but for me, you have this kind of moment of realization. For me, it was, you can't go to university. You're not well enough. Your body isn't strong enough to cope with the pressures of moving out of your home, of, you know, meeting new people, you know, everything that Freshers Week, you're not well enough. And I was like, oh God, I'm going to be left behind. I need to, you know, I'm going to be living at home with my parents, you know, which is fine. And I think I should have had a gap year to get better, but I knew I didn't want to. And in a way, I went to Loughborough, which is really healthy, and kind of health was so important. Their team there were great, and it was the best thing to do because I was surrounded by other 19 year olds who didn't care, who would, you know, eat what they wanted. And I was like, oh, actually, you know, I'll never be that relaxed, but maybe this shouldn't rule my life.
Definitely.
And that it was a healthy place to be in, you know, sport wise. I wasn't well enough to run. I couldn't run. I had a really good, I was in a really good care with, you know, experts kind of, and they were like, your body isn't
like
strong.
And
you can't
run.
And, you know, but I knew that for me, doing exercise helped me accept that food was like fuel and food wasn't scary. So I used to swim because I think when you're in the water, no one can see your body. No one could see what I looked like.
Yeah.
And you can't listen to music. You can't look at your phone. And it was just, I'd just swim. And then once you kind of build muscle, you can run. And then it kind of helped me, you know, I don't think I have the perfect diet, but it helped me relax about food and not care. I think as long as you're not restricting, I think that's the word I use. If you're saying, no, I'm not going to eat that because I haven't done this, that's worrying.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be how it is, but I think you've done like a monologue.
It's really interesting to get that insight. One of the things you said there is I've heard Tom say the same thing about this kind of myth or this misconception about having to earn food, food, something that you earn through exercise,
especially in running.
Everyone
equates it's all about, and I mean the food and fuel thing is 100% like from a very basic biological element. Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of like the growth that sort of changed from into a, like a real earn system.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think is unhealthy, right? Like you shouldn't have to feel like you are earning food because food's, I don't think it should be looked at in that as that kind of a reward for exercise. You know, it's like an essential part of life.
Because then you get that trade-off as if you haven't done it, you don't eat it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You, after you're swimming and getting strong again, and then the running came back in. Were you running before?
A little bit. Like I've grown up in a family of runners, so I'd always, you know, I don't think, looking back at pictures of me, I don't think I was never overweight. I'm quite small, I wasn't overweight. But I think it was, in my head, it's that body dysmorphia. I thought I was overweight.
Yeah.
So I'd run a bit then. But I would, you know, I never properly ran. I kind of sprint off at a million miles an hour and then walk for a bit. You know, I wasn't like a runner. But then after the swimming, I kind of discovered running. And then, it just kind of carried on from there. I think running was quite good for me in that you can see improvements. And I could see as I ate better, I could run not faster, but better. Like not, you know, run for longer. And it became kind of a thing where it's easy to, not easy, but with running, you can see an improvement quicker. With swimming, you can't really because I didn't have a watch. I just go for a swim.
It's harder to measure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Harder to measure.
And it kind of then turned. Now I don't really. But I think it helped, with running, it really helped because you can tell if you haven't eaten properly, it's really hard. Yeah. And it kind of helped me think, oh, actually, you know, carbs weren't scary anymore. And I definitely had, when I was ill, I had foods that were safe and foods that weren't. And anything, you know, I think unlike other eating disorders, with mine it was very much healthy food, everything, it was vegetables, that was all I'd eat.
Right.
And it was kind of similar to the newer eating disorders that have just been diagnosed where everything has to be healthy.
Yeah, the orthorexia
Yeah,
stuff.
It was like that, and that everything has to be healthy. I wouldn't eat cheese, I wouldn't eat chocolate, I wouldn't eat anything that was kind of had any fat in. And, you know, with exercising more, I realised that actually those foods are okay. And I think I remember having conversations with, you know, experts who were kind of like, I don't know if exercise is good. I think, you know, you should get to a certain weight before. But I just knew that I think you don't ever fully recover from an eating disorder. I think it's something you manage and you live with.
Right.
And you have good days and you have bad days and you have periods where it doesn't. But then you have, you know, something happens in your life and it's your coping. It's how you cope with something. And I think for me, if I didn't, I mean, I know that when I'm injured and I can't run, I get a bit kind of, and it's that kind of, I think that's, again, something that you have to manage, because you shouldn't, running shouldn't be something that you do.
You have to do.
You have to do to eat better.
Yeah.
It should, they should come hand in hand, but it did really help me, and I can completely see how it can go the other way.
Yeah.
And you can become obsessed with running and being lighter.
Mm.
But for me, it's definitely a way to relax about, you know, to think, oh, I can eat that, or I can have this for dinner, or, you know, I can, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's kind of helped me just calm down about it, I guess.
Because
it was just, I think you have that really obsessive personality, and it helped me just kind of chill out about it.
It's interesting you say that, but you never really get over an eating disorder, or you get over it, but it's kind of with you for life. It's the same way that people talk about other addictions, it's the same thing, you know?
I think it's always there. I don't, you know, luckily I have the people around me that know, so I know, but I know myself that I can fall into little habits and I think, oh, I didn't do that today, and oh, I didn't eat that today, and that's really dangerous. And straight away I'll kind of, you know, get on the phone to my mum and be like, oh, and she'll be kind of like, no, come on. And it's, you've got those people. I had a brilliant counsellor who's like a friend, and she's always there. I can drop her a text, and I don't need it right now, but I know that sometimes when things happen, that's my way of coping, to kind of then look at what I'm eating and what I'm running, and that's not right. And but I think once you've gone through it and got over it once, you're kind of, you know how to deal with
it.
And you're, and that's what I guess I'd encourage anyone that was really struggling to get that. It's kind of like a team, like get that team who know how, what works for you. And for me, it's telling people, because once you've told people that I'm struggling with this a bit, they're kind of like, okay, like, what should we do to help? And it's not in your head anymore. It's not your problem. Yeah. It's everyone's helping you.
Yeah.
So I think that's what works for me, but for other people that might not work. But I think definitely talking about it, and, you know, GPs just having the right language would really help. And as I said, if I'd seen the right people a lot earlier, it would never have got that bad, and I'd have never, you know, missed those years of school, missed those years of my life, I guess. Those kind of, all my friends going on those end of school holidays, I couldn't go, I wasn't well, and I wouldn't have missed all that. But I don't regret it, because I think it would have happened at some point in my life anyway. I think I've got that personality.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So I came across a few eating disorder stats based on a report by which was commissioned by Beat, and so here's four of them I think are probably the most telling. So more than 725,000 people in the UK are affected by an eating disorder. About one in 250 women and one in 2,000 men will suffer from anorexia at some point, and it usually develops at around 16 or 17 years of age. Bulimia is around 2 to 3 times more common than anorexia, and about 90% of people with bulimia are female. And global studies have shown that there is a 20% higher prevalence among athletes of all ages and abilities to develop a dysfunctional relationship with food.
The final one about this, the 20% prevalence among athletes, I mean, that we're going to talk to Rini a bit more about orthorexia.
Yeah.
But I think that that's something that I think eating disorders, everyone kind of assumes anorexia and bulimia are kind of like your two things. But the orthorexia is very much one of increasing concern within, you know, performance sport and general life, I think.
Yeah, definitely. We should just qualify that orthorexia is essentially the kind of unhealthy obsession with healthy food, and it's one that I think, if you know, I've been really lucky, mate. I've never had like an eating disorder, certainly not one I could diagnose as such, but I do understand the orthorexia one more, because I think there have been periods in my life where I've been very, I would have called it very, very disciplined with eating, but the idea of saying no to desserts almost out of principle, which I think actually was about control, and it was about a kind of slight obsession with being a better runner. I do understand how runners of a certain mindset can get into that.
Yeah, I mean, as a tipping point, for sure. I've done particularly strict diet things before. I took part in a sort of body transformation-y type thing, which was where I tracked all my macros.
This is like the men's health.
Yeah. So I did it, and I first of all, I want to say I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It hasn't had any knock-on effect. I eat lots.
Yeah.
But it was super interesting to measure my intake. For 12 weeks.
Yeah.
And I can see you.
I think the most interesting part of it is you can very much see how easily you could slip into the habit.
Yeah.
Because you see results.
Yes.
I think that's one of the main things. You suddenly see, I was much stronger. I had all the muscly bits.
Yeah.
It was kind of as it was meant to happen. And, you know, you sort of realise that by training hard and by eating certain amounts of food, you get a result. And I think that is the main focus of a lot of people.
Mm.
And I think that that's where an issue comes.
And that's kind of aesthetic fitness,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's aesthetics.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Part of our hope is that people email us and let us know, you know, their own perspectives and opinions on it. Because like I say, it's a complicated subject. I think it's all about getting people talking more. So yeah, that's podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Healthy eating is a good thing. We all know that. But is it possible to have too much of a good thing? Renee McGregor's book, Orthorexia, discusses the unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. She's joining us on the phone now to tell us more. Hi, Renee, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yep, good, thank you very much. So most people are familiar with terms such as anorexia and bulimia, but orthorexia is less well known. What exactly is it?
So orthorexia is a fairly new term with regards to eating disorders. It's not actually yet a diagnosable condition. So with anorexia, bulimia and binge eating disorder, you find them in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistic Manual for Mental Health. But orthorexia yet hasn't been defined like that. However, we are, as practitioners, seeing more and more more and more people with this. And basically, it's an obsession with eating purely. It's an obsession with eating cleanly. So the whole kind of hashtag clean eating campaign, if you want to call it, trend, whatever you want to call it, that came through a few years ago and kind of bombarded our social media, I guess that's had a lot to do with it. I never say that social media or even trends and campaigns cause a problem, but it has definitely started this obsession with eating particularly, should we say.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the questions that it might invite is, you know, how can it be unhealthy to eat healthy food?
Absolutely. I mean, I would definitely say it's good to eat healthily, being a registered dietitian, and I would definitely advocate that myself. But it's when it becomes obsessive, so it's a point where it starts to take over your life. So where food starts to create anxiety, or to the point where you can't deviate. So, you know, like most of us will be fairly mindful of what we eat. We'll, you know, try and have more fruit and veg. We'll probably try and cut back on the sugar. But then, you know, a friend might ring up and say, do you fancy going out for a glass of wine and a pizza? And we'll be fine with that. We can do that. We don't have any issues. It doesn't cause us anxiety. It doesn't make us come up with excuses. Where it becomes obsessive, the healthy eating, is when you just can't deviate from your food rules.
Right,
you've
right.
created these really, really strict parameters in which you work within, and beyond that, it just causes you too much anxiety. And so obviously that's not helpful for you from a health point of view, but even also from a mental health point of view, because, you know, the more rigid you become in the way you think about food and training, the more isolated you become. And obviously we do know from various psychological models that the more isolated somebody becomes, the more withdrawn they become, the more delusional they can become, in terms of they start to get more and more intrusive thoughts, which makes them think that they're not worthy, they're not good enough, people don't like them. And it kind of is that self-perpetuating cycle of just not feeling particularly good in yourself.
You mentioned the sort of the way that training and eating sort of go hand in hand. Have you sort of seen any trends where people who train, and particularly runners, are particularly susceptible to orthorexia?
Oh, hugely, hugely. I would say probably about 70%, maybe even 80% of the people I see in clinic now are individuals who've got a very disordered and dysfunctional relationship with food and training. I think, you know, we, as runners, as triathletes, as cyclists, you know, whatever sport you do, when you take it to a level, and even at a recreational level, when you take it to a competitive level and you're fairly disciplined with your training, you are probably of a certain nature, right? Like you are somebody who is probably very determined and very focused, and so it's very easy to see how one extreme behaviour can kind of go into another extreme behaviour. So, you know, I think something like orthorexia or eating disorders in general, they are not about food and body image. That's just a symptom that's being used. So, what's really going on is this real discomfort, this real anxiety, this unacceptance of who you are at a fundamental kind of deep rooted level, and it's that that feels very, very uncomfortable. Like, it doesn't feel nice to be you. That's the only way I can describe it, really. It's really hard to explain what I mean, but it's just, you just feel really uncomfortable in yourself. But the problem is, you're not really interpreting that discomfort as anxiety or not working out that it's about how you perceive yourself. Because of, I suppose, the way in which we experience it and the way in which society kind of gives us these ideals of what we should be like, we start to deflect that onto things like exercise, food, body image, because it's easy to think, oh, somebody's happy, somebody's you know, got a great life because they look great, because they're smiling in their Instagram photo, and you know, it's really easy to kind of assume that that's real. And I suppose the thing with orthorexia is people usually develop orthorexia, or even to a degree anorexia. It's kind of like you're going in search of a way of trying to improve this feeling. It's not about improving yourself, but it's like you're looking for something, you're looking for that answer, that kind of golden nugget that's going to make you feel complete.
I mean, you mentioned it before with like, you know, the kind of hashtag clean eating and Instagram and Facebook, and how maybe they're not helping with these kind of conditions. What role do you think social media has played in the rise of orthorexia?
So I have to say, a really big role. I mean, there was a study that came out last year from UCL, and there have been subsequent studies that are coming out at the moment that have shown that individuals that are on Instagram have a 49% increased prevalence of developing orthorexia compared with those that are not on Instagram or social media, where it's less than 1%.
Okay, wow.
So that's a big statistic to kind of work with. And equally, there's a new study that's coming out. It'll probably be out early next year, but I've just read the I've just been asked to review it from a professional point of view, and it's basically showing the link between people that do sport, particularly things like running and triathlon, and the risk of orthorexia. And there's a much higher risk, almost like a 40% higher risk, of individuals who are within sport to develop orthorexia. So there's a big link. And I think with the whole sort of social media, the issue is that you have so many people giving out their own opinions about what you should and shouldn't do, what you should and shouldn't wear, and how you should be. And I think when you are somebody who's quite vulnerable, you know, when you're not feeling great in yourself, I mean, I'm sure you and I can both probably remember an evening or a time in the day at some point where you haven't felt particularly confident. You go on social media and you're almost your worst when you come off. Yeah. Somebody else seems to be achieving and you're like, well, yeah, I'm not doing very much with my time. And I think that's it. You've got to remember, that's how you feel occasionally. Yeah. When you've got somebody who's very vulnerable, who's constantly beating themselves up, who's constantly self-critical and can't see what good they really are, they're constantly upwardly comparing themselves to all these images on social media. And it's really hard for them to actually work out what's reality.
Is it easy for someone, if you were concerned about a friend or someone, are there telltale signs that you can use to spot someone who is suffering from orthorexia so that you can try and help?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the biggest thing would be, you know, if they're constantly refusing to eat out with you or even eat at your house, you know, they can't cope with you preparing something, or they'll say, oh, yeah, I'll come on, but I'll bring my own stuff because I'm on this special diet or whatever, you know, they'll create an excuse. Orthorexia is not always associated with obsessive exercising, but it's definitely associated with an obsessive need to be healthy. So you often see health trends, definitely. So you might find that they get a little bit agitated if they can't, you know, say, for example, you have agreed to go out for brunch, but the place you're going to go to where they've obviously feel comfortable going is shut for whatever reason. They'll probably get very agitated about the fact that that's shut and they can't go there, and then they may even call the whole thing off. You know, it's that kind of extreme. They may also be fairly evangelistic about what they're doing. So we're seeing a big rise, and I'm going to be careful about how I put this, but we are seeing a big rise of people becoming vegan. And veganism is a very, very easy way of disguising orthorexia, because you're immediately removing food groups. Yeah. So I'm not anti-veganism. I think you can have a really good, well-balanced diet being a vegan, and I have nothing against it at all. I think it can be a good way of doing things. However, when you become vegan and then on top of that you become sugar-free and you don't have, you're insisting on having kind of almond rather than soya milk, and we know that soya milk's got a lot more nutrition than almond milk, where you may even become, someone become gluten-free as well as vegan, do you see what I mean? Like, it becomes more and more restrictive. Then I think you've got a problem. I think then you've got to start asking questions. Are you doing this for the right reasons? Like I said, the thing about veganism, it gives you a disguise, gives you a perfect disguise to hide away from orthorexia, because you legitimately can go, well, I'm vegan, so I can't do that.
Do you think, really, there's enough information and support out there for runners who are suffering from this stuff? Because I know that you're starting the Train Brave initiative to kind of help out in this world. Yeah.
So there's a couple of things. Like, I'm very fortunate because I do work in high performance sport, and as with everything, that very few percentage of people that are in high performance elite level sport, they generally get help more than the general public. And so one of the reasons that Tom and I came together and to develop Train Brave is we wanted to make something accessible for everybody. I think even in the high performance world, it's been slow to kind of like picking up on the fact that this is a problem. However, REDS is a really big buzzword now, and the REDS is relative energy deficiency in sport. It's the kind of term we use in sport, right. And it's a big buzzword. We're seeing it commonly in athletes at a high level. And I've just written some guidelines, and we've got a new resource called, in fact, I'm just going to look it up because I've forgotten, which is not great, is it? It's called Health for Performance. It's a new website coming out, which I've written with a number of other, so we're on an advisory board, a number of other academics and clinicians for BASES, the kind of British Association of Sports Medicine. Yeah. So we've got that as a resource coming out, and which we hope will really help coaches and athletes. And then, like I said, Train Brave is something that Tom and I have collaborated on. And I see this on a daily basis. I mean, literally not a single day goes past without me getting a new referral of somebody struggling with their relationship with food, training, and it's affecting and impacting not just their mental health but their physical health as well. So to answer your question, I don't think there has been enough, but I feel like there is definitely a movement, and I'm really hoping that we're going to create a really safe space for people, because I think sometimes it can be difficult when it's just a website or when it's like a workshop, or like I know, like within UK sport, they've got coaches development workshops, and they're kind of giving athletes access to mental health practitioners and all that kind of thing. But again, that's the top end. We have this kind of second tier of athletes who are all running within different clubs across the whole of the UK, and within that, a high percentage are struggling with dysfunctional relationships with food. And so those are the individuals that Tom and I are hoping to target and offer some guidance and advice about what to look out for, what impact it can have, the consequences, both from a personal perspective but also what I see as a clinician in this area. But then also we want to really create a safe space. We want to ask them what they want. Also, we hope this will start people looking for help as well.
Yeah, well, I think it's absolutely great what you and Tom are doing. And really, thanks very, very much for making time to speak with us for the Runner's World podcast. And we'll include a link to the events and the various support that people can get if they've got a problem with training and food. Thanks very much.
No worries. That's great. Thank you for letting us have a chat with you guys.
No, not at all. Pleasure.
Cheers, Rooney.
Thanks a lot.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Chrissy Wellington, Tom Fairbrother, Renee McGregor and Jane Maguire, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this is recorded.
For more from Runner's World, why not visit our website, runnersworld.co.uk, where you'll find more news, reviews and interviews from the wide world of running.
If you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate the podcast on iTunes. And thanks very much for listening. We will see you next month.
See ya!
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.